Girls are gross, Lee Marvin is cool, but Hasta La Vista Baby is cooler, and there is no escape from Paris Island. Those are the debatable facts Teddy and I wrestled with the summer of the 10th year of our lives, just before Teddy was forced to ship out. "We're moving, Mickey," he told me, a catch in his voice. "Dad got a job with another company, Dynex or something. We have to move to..." Teddy's voice cracked. "To the south." "How far south? I mean, maybe it's close, like Maryland or Virginia." He shook his head and then looked at me with hazel eyes already swelling with fear and loss. "It's Georgia," he whispered, "where the judges got bloodstains on their hands." I knew what Teddy was thinking. He was thinking of that song, "The Night the Lights Went Out in Georgia." "That's just a song, Teddy," I said. "I don't want to go. They're all hicks down there." "I'll come down there with you," I said cheerfully. "It's not that far." Teddy snorted. "No, you won't." "Sure I will." I propped up my double-pump squirt gun, shot a heroic burst into the sky that made a rainbow over the fallen green and red apples around us, and knelt there so I looked like square-jawed Lee Marvin in the Dirty Dozen. "You just bet I will," I said. Facts of youth. Teddy shipped out and we hardly kept up, which is the way of things for a 10-year-old boy when life comes at you too fast to take account of all those things you are leaving behind. But on the bus, I do think about Teddy again for the first time in years and the war games we used to play and how fun it was. I suppose those games have something to do with where I'm headed. Not Georgia, but close enough. South Carolina, right on the border, in fact. It's wet outside, and I can see the way the streetlights glisten on the pavement. And I'm wondering if it always rains here, or if it's just the way the county is. Buford County, that is. The name reminds me of a country song, and the bus is full of country guys. Hicks, as Teddy would say, and I can smell marijuana that one of the guys, who must be nuts, has tried to smoke in the bathroom. I can also smell the stink of Buford County, which is like a sewer overladen with marsh, and there is a salty feel to the air. It's 3 a.m, and my eyes are heavy. The voices are getting progressively quieter as we drift closer to Paris Island. A lurch, and the bus just stops. A great commotion kicks in. We are led onto the pavement where little orange footprints mark where we are supposed to put our feet. And then, after hours of yelling and straightening, badgering, and swearing, we are led into the barracks. 2 men appear in dapper drill instructor uniforms, a short Vietnamese guy named Nhung, and a big white lantern jaw guy named Larson, a real Lee Marvin kind of character. He is the chief drill instructor. He does not look at me. He looks through me. What he sees, I think, is a kind of penumbra of possibility, and also that which disgusts him most in each of us. With me, I know it's the beard. There's Clement next door, and I know it's his teeth and his homely freckles. Then there's Tarot, who I met on the bus, a Puerto Rican from New York with tattoos on his knuckles that say live or evil, depending on how he holds his fist. With Thoreau, it's his pent-up anger and his hidden hurt, a useful, energetic guy, but in need of molding. For some, I think maybe there is no disgust. Merton is a nearly perfect specimen. For others, there's something beyond disgust, if that's possible, that will yield the terrible designation unsat, unsatisfactory. He's already seen the unsats among us, I think. Fat Creasy, Pretty Boy Swanson, and poor Eagleton, who never had a chance. We are told to stay up the whole night. It's easily 4 or 5 in the morning, and we are all exhausted. In a large room decorated with Marine Corps mottos, we have to memorize things like Fortis Fortuna Jovit, Fortune Favors the Brave, or the more prosaic, Hell in a Helmet. We sit at high school desks, the type that have their flat top metallically bonded to their stools. If one of us nods his head or bends his neck or, God forbid, folds his arm to rest his head upon, then the screaming commences. The cloud of fear is at 18,000 feet in this place, and rich and mean and dark is the stool of Zeus. The whole day we stay in that room, and one by one we falter. Sometimes we are made to stand. Other times we are allowed to sit. Never are we allowed to sleep. At 5 o'clock that afternoon, they strip us, shave us, and give us bunks. It's an extraordinary upheaval, the most exciting thing, actually, that's happened to us since getting off the bus. My beard is gone, my skull is bare. I look in the mirror, and it occurs to me that I resemble nothing so much as a Jewish refugee. Larson makes a big speech that evening. He gathers us all on the parade deck at twilight, says that some 20% of us will be recycled, that is, sent back through training again, and that another 15% won't make it at all. But the ones who do make it, the few, the proud, etc., will be serving a far greater community. He points to the distant well of night that surrounds us, and to the west, where we can see the sprinkle of lights from the mainland, or at least that's what I think they are. That way is home, boys. You're serving those people, your mothers, your fathers, your sisters, your brothers. They are counting on you, those good people. Don't let them down. Then he dismisses us, and Nagon takes up the baton, explaining in excruciating detail how any one of us that gets the asinine idea that we can escape Paris Island are in for a rude awakening. Sharks, he says, the size of orca whales patrol the waters around the islands. They don't eat so well, but about once a year a recruit is foolish enough to try to swim off the island, and then there's a big old picnic. But probably because he's Vietnamese, he has a hard time saying recruit, so it comes out like recruit. But most recruits, he says, don't make it to the water. Most get sucked up in the plow mud, which is like quicksand, or they get bitten by snakes, or they get lost in the infernal marsh, until starvation takes them out, and then the blue crabs dine on their bleached bones. No recruit escapes Paris Island, he says, waits for a beat, and then adds, ominously, alive. By 8 that night, we are allowed to sleep, and even though we are exhausted, fragmented, probably on the edge of psychosis, the natural urge to say something assails us, and we start talking. The next thing you know, the ceiling lights flood our barracks, and Nyong is in the middle of the bay, screaming his agitation and demanding to know who has been talking. No one says a word. Which one of you was it? Silence. We are all forced to slide out of our bunks and to do push-ups. After the third round of 25 push-ups each, Eagleton starts complaining that he can't do any more. As a general rule, can't is a bad word here. There are other bad words I am learning, mostly negatives, like won't or couldn't. Can't, from the mouth of a recruit, is an invitation to pain. Eagleton hasn't caught on yet, and I would feel sorry for him if his stupidity didn't cost us all another 3 rounds of push-ups and 2 less hours of sleep. So I suppose what happens that next week is inevitable. The guys come to me because I'm his bunkmate, Taro and Trawler at first, which doesn't surprise me. They're from the city, and it's up to them to play enforcers. That's the way they see it. They said they've talked to Merton, and he's okay with this. Tonight, they say, there's going to be some noise, some scuffling below me. Just ignore it. I'm sitting on my footlocker trying to write something inspirational to Rita Manotti, who I was dating before I left to boot camp and who swore eternal love at the point of my departure, which means, I guess, that she may or may not be dating Bud Esther about now. I still enjoy that last kiss, though. The heartfelt way she seemed to give up her entire being through her mouth, that one spectacular goodbye, all lips and tongues and crushing hug. I feel it once again and think of her with Bud Esther. It's awful. I'm something of a saint when it comes to the human animal. I glance across to Merton, who looks like a perfectly sculpted image of a jarhead. Like if Norman Rockwell had done oils of grunts shining their boots, Merton could have been a model. He's over there talking to Creasy about something. Yesterday, Creasy had a bad asthma attack, slipped off the log climb, fell 15 feet, and nearly broke his neck. We had gathered around him, flopping on the mud in pain, gasping for air like a landed fish, until the DIs chased us away. Merton sees me and the two ghouls, Taro and Trawler, and he makes the slightest little dip with his square chin, like Lee Marvin signing off on the booze for his dirty dozen. That's all I need. I shrug, tell Taro and Trawler to keep it quiet. Rules are rules. I'm not opposed to breaking them, mind you, but I sure don't want to get caught. That day is a busy day. Firing range, then a little light SERE training, getting doused with C2 gas, tear gas that is, which Nyong happily says will make you want to puke. He is gleeful. Now this gas mask is your friend. He swings the gas mask prop in front of us, and it looks like a dead plastic rat with a huge tail. Some of the gas masks don't work so well, he explains, still happy. Besides, you will be removing gas mask for 30 seconds in the chamber, so that you may experience firsthand the exquisite pleasure of gas warfare. Before we enter the chamber, I glance over at Fatboy Creasy, who looks petrified. He's always kind of pale and blubbery, but standing in front of the wooden hut where they are going to pump in the tear gas, Creasy looks like he's going to puke before he even gets the first whiff. Merton notices this too. What's the matter? He asks. Creasy whispers something to Merton, and Merton immediately requests permission to speak to Nyong. Generally, whenever anyone asks permission to speak, Nyong has a single-word retort, denied. But this time, perhaps sensing something going on with Creasy, or maybe just because it's his golden boy Merton, he relents. Merton explains that Creasy's health condition would become worse with C2. He could die. Nyong finds the explanation improbable, but allows that Creasy can do push-ups while Merton and the rest of the platoon enter the tear gas chamber. Then Nyong explains, with an especially delighted look in his eye, the platoon can arrange to transport Creasy for the 2-mile return hike to the barracks after the C2 expedition. That all seemed a little vague to us until after we came out of the chamber, our eyes burning from the gas, our noses dripping, our stomachs in rebellion. For the next 2-mile hike back, we had to carry Creasy. Whenever his feet touched the ground, Nyung was on us to query the load, query the load. He howled and we queried. But after that, every one of us took a serious interest in Creasy's dietary intake. He easily weighed 200 pounds, and whenever we saw him doubling up on cereal, one of us would make it our business to take the extra carton of Honey Oats or Frosted Flakes off his tray and eat it for him. Fat boy Creasy's weight was going to kill us otherwise. By the time we make it back to our bunks that evening, I've completely forgotten what Toro and Trollo are planning, and I'm so exhausted I wouldn't hear it if an M80 was going off below me. But in the middle of the night, I do wake up. The entire bunk is shaken, like I'm in a Class 5 earthquake, and I'm practically tossed out onto the floor. I make a grab for the post and lean my head over to see what's going on. It's pitch black, but the light for the head is still on, so I can see the hazy outlines of muscles and arms and white t-shirts bending over Eagleton below me. "Hey, you guys, knock it off," I hiss. They just keep thumping him. I try to get a sense of how many there are, but before I can get an accurate count, they disperse, and all I can hear after that is Eagleton making a whimpering sound. In the morning, I look at him, and there's not a bruise on his face. But when we're in the showers, I see his back and belly, and it's like there's a river of purple and blue streaming around his midriff and chest. By any rational standard, that should have been enough to shut him up. It certainly would have shut me up. But Eagleton's not quite rational, as I say. I talk to him confidentially that evening, just before lights out. "Look, just keep your mouth shut. It's the only way we're going to make it through this thing, okay?" He says, "Okay, all right," in a defeated way, but I still don't believe him. The next day, Creasy has another bad spell, and Merton is there, working over him like a mother as usual. Creasy's gasping for air after a long sprint, and I'm beginning to wonder why they let someone with asthma in through the Marine Corps to begin with, when Eagleton slides in beside me, staring at him. "He lied," he says. The DIs are honest before I can ask what he means, but later that afternoon at chow, I ask him, "What do you mean when you said that about Creasy lying?" "He got a doctor or someone calling himself a doctor to sign off on his form for him. They wouldn't normally let his type in. My brother did the same thing, but they let him go through because they've got a recruiting shortage now." "Your brother had asthma?" "My brother had a back condition, chronic lower back pain, CLBP. He lied about it to the recruiters. They took him on his word, put him into basic. How'd it go?" "Rotten. But he made it through training. They didn't care as long as he kept moving. An IED blew off his leg outside Fallujah." Eagleton was quiet, and I decided I didn't want to say anything, but I couldn't help but ask, "But why would you join after something like that?" Before he could answer, Clement slides in next to us. He's a tall, spindly fellow with freckles and big teeth who is very pious, always praying before he partakes of his meals. I try to avoid eating with him because on the first day we were at chow, Clement asked me why I wasn't praying before I ate, and I had to explain that I didn't pray. Then he said, "Do you want me to pray for you, Mickey? I could ask Jesus Christ to become your personal savior." "I'm Jewish," I said. That didn't seem to connect for Clement. "Well, Jews can pray too," he said, and he made an elaborate point of this. "You know, that Jesus Christ actually was a Jew. I mean, before he was Christ." For a moment, it almost looked as though he had confused himself, when he was a boy. So I explained to Clement that I was an atheist as well as being a Jew. That was a big mistake. "Well, why would you be in the Marine Corps if you're an atheist? You don't believe in nothing?" "That's not what atheism means," I said. "It just means I don't believe in a supreme deity. I mean, look around, Clement. You think a supreme and beneficent deity spent his infinite wisdom designing someone like Creasy with 2 faulty lungs and an obsessive eating malfunction? Or crafting Young, for that matter?" "Jews are people of the book. You have to believe in God. You're Jewish." I should have just dropped it then, of course. There was no good outcome for the conversation, but sometimes you can't just let stuff go. So I grabbed a napkin and I drew a circle. "Look at this, Clement. Now imagine that in this circle are all the Jews in the world, okay?" Clement nodded. Then I drew another circle that intersected that circle. "Now in this circle are all the religious people in the world. Do you see where the 2 circles intersect? Those are all the religious Jews in the world. I'm in the larger circle, but not in the smaller one. Do you get it?" "I'm praying for Jesus to forgive you now." I relented a little. "Okay, Clement, maybe I'm not completely atheist. Maybe I'm more agnostic. It just means I doubt, okay? I have problems with the concept, but I might buy into it in the long view. I balled up the Venn diagram after that, but that didn't dissuade Clement. Only made it worse. Now he's always making an elaborate show of praying whenever he sees me. Today is no different. He sits down opposite Eagleton and bows his head in a show of piety. Eagleton gets up and leaves, and when Clement is done, he asks me if I've finally accepted Jesus Christ as my personal savior, and I tell him again that I'm a Jew and an agnostic, and if he keeps praying for me, I'm definitely flipping over to atheism. There are no atheists in foxholes, he says. We're not in a foxhole, Clement. God can still forgive you, he says. Sure, I said. But the real question is, can he forgive you? This seems to blow his circuits. In an expression of supreme indignation, he picks up his chow tray and leaves. I'm thinking this is an impressive moment until Pretty Boy Swanson slides in right behind him. I've got one more bite of chipped beef left, and all I want to do is swallow this cuisine in peace and leave. But before I can get it into my mouth, Swanson says, "You know, they douse this stuff with saltpeter." He leans forward with a conspiratorial gleam in his eye. He is actually pretty, hence his nickname. He has beautiful blue eyes like Paul Newman with dark lashes and dark eyebrows. I try not to look. "Do you know what saltpeter does?" he asks. "Sure, it, you know, kills your urges." "It destroys desire." Swanson rolls his eyes. "You seem intelligent." "Thanks," I say, smiling. "Likewise." "It's simple, the supplements they add to almost anything." "Like what?" "Anything that can be disguised, like any gravy substance." He nods towards the cream chip beef that's on my fork halfway to my mouth. I have no idea how he's managed so far. From every possible angle, Pretty Boy should have been doomed from the first day in. He's obvious as a heart attack. I shove the last forkful into my mouth. "Well, it's just not healthy." "Look, Swanson, we just spent yesterday afternoon puking our guts out because the DIs decided getting dosed with a level 2 chemical weapon would increase the odds of us surviving a gas attack on a battlefield in Iraq. Do you honestly think that anyone here is concerned with the erotically inhibitive substances they might be adding to our food supply?" Swanson only mutters, "Well, they ought to be." I smile, pick up my tray, and move across the chow room, spying Creasy sitting at a corner table opposite Taro. I angle it just right, snag the extra biscuit he's got hanging off the edge of his tray, and stuff it into my mouth, but not before barking out, "Diet, fat boy." Rumor has it for a while that Creasy is going to be shipped home or sent to a special platoon, but thanks to pleading by Merton, he is still in formation that next morning. Maybe he's taken an extra dose of asthma medication, because Creasy does pretty well that day. He doesn't fall over on the log climb or collapse on the track, but by 9 that evening, we're doing triple sets of push-ups again thanks to one of Eagleton's questions, and I can hear Creasy's breath already collapsing in the narrow confines of the barracks. But Young is especially mad, or maybe the head DI, Larson, has been especially abusive towards him lately. Or maybe there's a command from on high that we need to be more compliant. Whatever the cause, Young refuses to stop the push-ups, even though the whole barracks can hear Creasy practically dying, struggling to get out each one. I know he's on the verge of collapse, and worse, Eagleton knows it too. "This is nonsense, sir," Eagleton suddenly says. He just stops doing his push-up and stands there. An amazing thing. For those unfamiliar with the etiquette of boot camp, telling a DI that one of his instructions is nonsense, even lopping on the de rigueur, "sir," is tantamount to dropping a nuclear bomb on Idaho, say. Not a lot of people might get killed, but everyone is going to be really shocked. Young doesn't bat an eye. "For you, Eagleton, 20 more. We all stop while Eagleton pumps out his 20 extra. No big deal, but then Young does something strange. He tells Creasy that he has to pump out 20 extra, too. Eagleton is finishing up while Creasy is getting down and beginning another count. I know Merton is horrified. I can see his face twisted in disbelief. But he doesn't say a word. Neither do I, for that matter. Creasy is exhausted, I think. Nearly finished. This is beyond cruelty. This is dangerous. This is going to kill the guy, I think. I know all this, and I still can't say a word. I'm like that experiment they did in the 60s. I read about it. Stanley Milgram sending electric shock through his patients. We will all just stand there and watch so long as the DI says it's okay. Except for Eagleton. He won't be quiet. He finishes his 20 and gets back into formation. But as soon as he realizes Creasy is gasping for air on the barracks floor again, he hollers, "Sir, permission to speak, sir." "Denied." "Sir, recruit Creasy is not well, sir."
I will determine how Recruit Queasy is. I will determine who in this platoon is well and who is not. I will determine the level of your health, the value of your breath. Do you understand me, you encephalitic abortion?
Yes, sir.
What? Sir, yes, sir.
Meanwhile, Creasy has finished and is back in line panting. Young doesn't take his eyes off Eagleton. He stares at his stumpy head and big, pale, blinking blues and asks if he thinks Creasy looks sufficiently healthy now. Eagleton says he does.
You'd think it would end there, but it doesn't.
Young is ticked off beyond the usual showboat ticked off the DIs are always doing. He's seriously miffed that Eagleton has second-guessed him, and maybe, underneath all of that, there's a little concern that he actually has overdone the PT for Creasy. He tells Eagleton to give him another 25, so Eagleton drops and begins pumping them out. Nyong gets in his face, says Eagleton sounds a little out of breath himself. Maybe he ought to get some of Creasy's asthma medicine. Maybe he ought to worry about his own health and not focus on Creasy. Or maybe all along, Eagleton didn't give a damn about Creasy. He just wanted to keep his lazy butt from doing PT. On and on until Eagleton is crying he can't do anymore. Can't! Young explodes. That's his trigger word. 25 minutes later, Eagleton is finally finished with his push-ups, and we're all lying in the barracks, staring at the ceiling, waiting for the blessed narcotic of sleep. In the dark, I tell Eagleton he has to cool out. There's a long bit of silence, and then he says, so I can just barely hear him, I'm getting out of here. I lean over the bunk and look down at him. Nobody gets out of here, dude. I can't see his face, but I can hear his breathing. No escape from Paris Island. That's one of the last nuggets of truth from my childhood, I think. I'm swimming off the island, he says. That's crazy. You have to walk through 3 miles of barracks just to get to the water. I can't take it anymore. Just keep quiet, I say. Just worry about yourself getting through. Let everyone else take care of themselves. For a long time, Eagleton doesn't say a word, and I'm practically asleep when he whispers finally, thanks. I don't say anything. He continues, you know, Mickey, you're the only person I can talk to here. Everyone else hates me. For a moment, I imagine myself like one of those sergeants in the war movies who are always pulling for the underdog, the one go-to guy that the weakling, the sap, the geek can count on. But somewhere in the bottom of my soul, I know, one way or another, Eagleton is going to be moving on. But I give him what amounts to a pep talk, telling him he's going to be a great asset, that the others are just scared of his principles, that he's got a lot of soul. I'm going into a long disquisition about all of this, laying it on thick and heavy, just like when I saw myself as Lee Marvin with the double-pump squirt gun, and I was telling Teddy how I'd go down south with him when I hear Tarot bark at us from 4 bunks down. Put a cork in it, you assholes. The next day, we're sitting around waiting our turn to wallop each other, senseless, with pugle sticks, basically a sport that involves slipping into a football helmet and pads and thumping the stuffing out of your opponent. Beats me why we even bother with this when we push buttons to send enough firepower to wipe out cities from miles away, but I guess it's good PT. I don't especially like the exercise, but thus far I've been lucky enough to get paired with guys from another platoon who are smaller than I am. While I'm sitting there, watching the recruits rushing at each other in the dust like trapped rhinoceroses, I find out from Merton that Creasy had a pretty severe asthma attack the other night. He took enough meds to keep himself going, but now Merton thinks he shouldn't stay in, but Creasy won't hear of it. When Eagleton gets wind of this, he tells me it's just like his brother, who wouldn't leave either. It becomes a point of honor, he says. It's like a sickness, like deforming your existence proves something beyond the self-deformation, you know? Well, why did you join, I ask. It's something I've been thinking to ask him all along. Why hitch up if your brother lost a leg and you're loath to follow orders? Eagleton rolls his eyes, draws stick figures in the sand, and says something like, I'm just too simple to understand. Boy, he's lucky because I get my orders to suit up next for the pugle stick match before I can smack his smug mug. I take it out on my opponent, poor guy, a short Hispanic fellow from Platoon 23. I come out furious, swinging a wild roundhouse that catches him square on the left side of his head. His helmet pops off like a champagne cork, and as he stumbles to retrieve his pugle stick, the DIs have to whistle me back before I pummel the guy. When I get back to my seat in the bleachers where Eagleton is still waiting his turn, he eyes me with a hint of humor. Very impressive, he says. Wait till we get to the grenade throw, I tell him. Swanson is next. Our platoon is down by 2 points, but by the time Swanson is done, we're up by 3. I'm amazed at how vicious and skillful he is with the pugle stick.
His opponent probably outweighs him by 80 pounds, but Swanson just dances around him, and every time he makes a thrust, Swanson swings around and catches him from behind with just enough of the stick to knock him off balance. It was almost as though he were playing around. "Dance," Eagleton says. He nods, looking at Swanson's performance. "You think?" I ask. "Can't you see it? Swanson's a dancer. That's how he outmaneuvers that guy every turn." Finally, in the last few seconds, Swanson finishes off his opponent with three masterful strokes from the bugle stick. "That's got nothing to do with the dance," I say. "High school major domo," says Eagleton. "Bet you $50. Our next guy up is Creasy. He's big enough, but uncoordinated, and not long on energy. We cheer, but that's just enough to ensure we only lose the 3 points that Swanson just made. So we're dead even when Eagleton is up. "Wish me luck," he says, and I do. But my wishes don't mean squat. Eagleton gets matched with some Neanderthal from the 8th platoon. The guy probably weighs 300 pounds. He stands 6'8" and looks to be interested in chewing the fat off live human beings for a pastime. There was no one that should have been matched with this creature. He should be in a cage match with himself. He would have destroyed me. He would have destroyed every guy in our platoon, including Thoreau, who is our toughest guy. So in a way, Eagleton was lucky, I guess. He only got knocked out. Probably the best outcome in the long run. It's kind of sad because we're all standing around the dusty fighting circle waiting for Eagleton to exhibit some form of awareness again. He's lying there like a spent dish rag. I'm thinking the guy is a hero, just to stand up against that ape, just to simply not run away. But Nguyen can't see it. The first thing he says when Eagleton finally comes around, blinks himself into awareness, is, "You lost the match by 3 points." In the bunk that night, staring up at the ceiling, waiting for lights out, Eagleton tells me again that he's leaving. "Just ignore Young. He's a moron," I say. "It's not that. It's the whole environment. I can't stand this. You're only 2 weeks out. I'll be dead before then." "Go to sleep, Eagleton," I say. "No one minds about the pugil stick thing. It was just Young being a creep." "Oh, they mind," whispers Eagleton. "And Thoreau. Thoreau claims he's going to beat the tar out of me the next time he sees me. He says he can't even stand looking at me." Poor Eagleton's voice is trembling. "I'll talk to Merton, all right. He'll keep Thoreau in line." "But why?" Eagleton asks. "Why do they hate me so much?" It's a question that has some truth to it. Lots of the recruits don't like him. I think it has something to do with his sense of superiority, some kind of smugness he gives off. But I lie. I tell him it doesn't matter, that Thoreau hates everybody. It's his hallmark. "Just go to sleep," I whisper, because I'm too beat to think about it anymore. And what good is talking going to do? I have guard duty that evening, which kicks in at 2 a.m. and lasts until 5 a.m. The worst hours, but in a perverse way, I like it. There's 3 hours of utter calm, all to yourself. You can let your mind go, dream of a Minotti girl or a Maserati. If you're of a philosophical bent, work out what kind of beneficent god would allow a place like Paris Island to even exist. Or for that matter, our rifles, our helmets, our gas mask, or our Willy Pete, what we call white phosphorus around here, this stuff that melts right through skin and bones as long as there is oxygen, it just won't stop burning. Wouldn't it make more sense to clothe the world in indigo and lace like Swanson might like and tell the warrior class to go hunt deer? I am of the warrior class, of course, I realize that, but there's no harm in speculation. I spend most of my shift marching inside the barracks, listening to the deep snores of the almost grown boys, watching a full moon leak through the panes of the barracks window. Near 3:15 a.m., I spy Eagleton. I know because I look at the clock overhead when I see him. He is dressed in full gear, but he has his boots in his hand. He's trying to get past me to the barracks door, but the moonlight advertises his presence like an ad for Joe Camel. I'm astonished that he's even trying this. At first, I don't say a word. I just follow his movement along the left-hand side of the barracks and maneuver my patrol so that I meet him 10 feet from the door. Then a light rain begins to fall, and I can hear it pinging on the tin roof. "What are you doing?" I hiss. Protocol suggests that I should confront him and order him back to his bunk. "I'm getting out of here," he says. "Not on my watch, dude. Are you crazy? They'll catch you before you get 5 feet." He has a wild look about his eye, though. Wild and determined. "No, I can do this. I've got it mapped out. 2 miles through marsh, then I swim across Battery Creek to Port Royal, and I've got saltine crackers," he adds. "I've been saving up all my crackers from the mess hall." "Your saltines," I almost laugh. "You're not worried about the sharks, the water, the moccasins, the spiders, the plow mud, because you've got saltines?" Eagleton snorts. "They just tell us all that to scare us. You don't think they have sharks off the South Carolina coast?" "I can go by the causeway, too," he said. "They've got palms lining the entire highway.
I'll just skinny up against the palms when a car approaches and they'll never see me. How are you going to get past the guard gate? It's 4 a.m. I bet he sleeps sometime, don't you think? I shake my head. I'm ordering you back, Eagleton. But he doesn't move. He just stands there by the door. Eagleton, I hiss. I don't want to bust him. Actually, I'm sure I won't bust him. I won't be able to bust him. But I'm feeling miserable thinking about all the flack I'm going to catch. Me and every other poor guy on sentry duty that night. My heart flutters. Eagleton turns, his eyes awash of pity and intransigence. He eases the knob to the door to the left, but before he can crack it open, the lights are on. The lights are on. It takes me a second to register what is happening, but as soon as I hear Nyong's voice behind me, I go in full cover my butt mode. Halt, I screech. I order you to halt. I have a rifle, of course, but it's still at port arms, and I have no ammunition in any case, but I aim it for dramatic effect. Halt, I shout again. Behind me, I can hear Nyong rousting the entire platoon, and now he's screaming for Eagleton to freeze where he is. There's this moment that I will probably remember forever. Eagleton standing there, weighing the odds of his life. Then another second, he's just gone, out the barracks door, stumbling down the steps. Before I can react, Nyong has ordered the entire platoon to give chase. And then he is beside me and past me, and Merton is there, sprinting to catch Eagleton, and behind him is Taro and then Trawler. Even Creasy barges out, gasping for air. I lope down the barrack steps after the guys. Eagleton didn't get 50 yards that morning, not even half a football field. Merton levels him with a flying tackle, and before I know what's happening, they're all on him. To tell the truth, I'm on him too. I want to make sure the others can see me tagging him a few times. I kick him once in the ribs with my boot, once, then twice, just to let the others know. Also, I'm angry at him for pulling this stunt. I almost feel righteous kicking him. I feel like one of the Dirty Dozen, maybe messing up a Nazi. When we're finally done, we drag Eagleton back to his bunk, and Young orders me to stand guard over him until roll call the next morning. Nelson takes up sentry duty. If he's gone the next day, it's on me. That's my punishment, I guess, for slacking, for talking when I should have been shouting. Eagleton's bleeding from his nose and mouth, and I'm betting he has a few cracked ribs, not least of which is due to my own kicking. But I'm still wired from that moment, and not feeling especially sorry for the guy. When he starts crying, Mickey, midway through the terrible tail end of that shift, I'm so scared and angry I tell him to shut up. But he won't be quiet. Mickey, he croaks. I'm not your friend, I whisper angrily. Shut the hell up. I don't want to hear it. Not another word. Not another sound. My hands are trembling. I'm so angry and nervous. If there's a moral point to the story, I can't find it anymore. Even when I'm standing there and I realize that Eagleton isn't making his whimpering sounds, I fail to note anything unusual. By the time Nyong appears for reveille, I'm just happy that there's been no commotion. I put my gear away and go to the head, splash cold water into my face, and shower and shave before everyone else is up. It's not until a roll call, when Eagleton doesn't get up, when Eagleton makes no sound at all, that I realize, along with everyone else in the platoon, just how far Eagleton has gone. The first thing I kill in Iraq is a dog, a vanilla brown and white spotted thing full of patchy skin and snarls. I felt bad about it because, even snarling, I could see his eyes are afraid. But the sergeant orders me to because we are reconnoitering an area where there might be terrorists. He figures a gunshot will be less likely to attract attention than a dog's bark. This is Iraq, after all. Besides, we might be coming back that night, and the dog is obviously going to be a problem. I kill 3 more dogs who are loitering near a dump that we think might be where the insurgency is setting up IEDs. I remember each one of those dogs. I remember their dark eyes, the whimpers they make when they die, the way they slump to the ground. One of the dogs looks like Sammy, a Jack Russell that Teddy used to have. The next thing I kill is a month later. It's a man in a Mercedes-Benz who doesn't stop at a checkpoint. I don't even see him when I kill him. I'm firing into a windshield that reflects back the blue sky and clouds over Iraq. I light him up. That's the way they say it. Lighting him up. Firing off about 15 rounds into the windshield. Alongside me, 2 other guys at the guard station light him up too. We have orders about cars that rush the checkpoint on account of the car bombs. Anything that doesn't stop,
Get stop. That's what the sergeant says. I follow orders. I mean, we all follow orders. I don't get a good look at the guy afterwards. Our sergeant takes pictures with his digital camera, an image for the records, or maybe to send to the good people back home. In a way, it's a trophy, I guess. My first terrorist. Only his car isn't rigged, and tell the truth, it looks like the only thing he's carrying is smuggled oranges from Kuwait. There's lots more that happens. None of it very good. Most of it, I'd prefer to forget. And then I guess I just do forget, because when I try to remember it now, nothing comes back but the dogs I killed and the guy in the Mercedes whose face I never saw. About 2 years later, I bump into Merton again. He has suffered a traumatic brain injury and face wounds from an IED in Anbar province, and he looks awful. His nose is a hole, and there's a huge gash where his left jaw should be. I've earned a Purple Heart for a minor leg wound, but we both end up at Walter Reed. His speech is slow and incongruous. At points, he stutters, and one time, he even cries. He looks like a caricature of his former perfect Marine self. We start talking about the platoon, and he says that he's been keeping up with some of the guys. Creasy made it to Afghanistan, he tells me. He's hanging out in SWAT, doing patrols in the desert there. Swanson went on to OCS training, believe it or not. He's now a captain. Clement got killed in Anbar province. His supplications and prayers didn't protect him, while my non-prayers got me out with a leg wound, at least temporarily. Go figure. Somehow, the conversation turns to Eagleton, and the morning he died in the bunk while I stood guard duty. No one blames you for that, he says. The funny thing is, it never occurred to me that I would get blamed for it. Yeah, that was weird, I say. And then I tell Merton about his brother and how he'd lost a leg, but Eagleton signed up anyhow. Why do you suppose he did that, I ask. Merton smiles, which stretches his face into a contortion. Jung told me Eagleton had a younger brother. He figured if he joined up, the younger brother would feel obligated to stay and help his old man in their gas station. So he joined to keep his younger brother out of the Corps? I guess, something like that, said Merton. But it didn't work. The old man died after Eagleton came back in a pine box and the kid signed up anyhow. Merton says with a really grim smile. The smile looks kind of demented because of the scars on his face and the big gash where his jaw should have been. No one escapes Paris Island, I say. I'm trying to sound tired and ironic. You know, that's not true. Merton sucks air in through his nose hole, making an eerie, hollow sound. There are quite a few cases of recruits that manage to escape Paris Island. It's not the island that has a perfect record. It's the good people on the mainland. They always turn the runaway recruits back in. He was on his way home from Candletop. Been 2 weeks gone and he thought he'd stop at Webb's and have him a drink before he went home to her. Andy Wolo said hello and he said hi. What's doing, woe? Sit down, I've got some bad news, it's gonna hurt.